Okay, tonight we're doing our Parsha on Parshas Pinchas. It's a special shiur tonight. We're doing it in memory of Mel Applebaum, our friend, our colleague, Kat Gray Buckman's father, who passed away about a month ago. The Shloshim is approaching, I think, tomorrow evening. And, you know, the learning of Torah, especially among friends and family, is a tremendous chus, a tremendous merit. And the hope and the bracha here is that the family should be able to be blessed with a measure of nechama, with a measure of consolation as they go through a very, very difficult time. So we're going to learn the parsha in his memory. Okay, let us begin. The parsha this week is Parshas Pinchas. Parshas Pinchas is a difficult parsha, a challenging parsha, specifically with the, you know, the character of the parsha, Pinchas himself, which we'll get into his story of what he did. It basically seems on the surface he was involved in some vigilante justice of killing Zimri, who was a nobleman of the tribe of Shimon, and while he was having relations with Zimri ben Salu, a Moabite, Cosby Batsur, rather, Cosby, the Moabite princess. And he went up there and he speared them both. We're going to get into that. So it brings up the area, something which is very relevant, is the topic of vigilantism in Judaism, and taking our, and considering if it's ever justified. I mean, we know that the Torah has lots of laws of a court, and there are judges, shoftim, there are also policemen called shotrim. So we have a juridical system. So what's going on with Parshas Pinchas? Now, the area of vigilantism is something which is alive and well in the newspapers. This past year, there was the phenomena called the group that was doing acts of violence and vandalism throughout Israel, particularly in the West Bank, and spray painting what they call price tag. Does anybody know anything about that whatsoever? Okay, so we're going to see two short video clips, which will bring everybody up to date. Which will be able to get us into the area. And I want you to listen carefully to some of the positions of the people. And we're going to discuss that in particular. So we're going to go right, as they say, we're going to go right to the video. Here we go, 1 second. Okay, so I don't want to show the whole video, I'm just going to show a clip. So the focus here is on a woman, a young woman named Mariah Goldberg. She's 20 years old, and she was arrested by the Israelis because she was throwing rocks at Arabs.
Goodbye. Okay.
What? Can you see? I didn't catch that. What was that, Michael?
No, I heard someone's computer turning off.
Okay. All right. Anyways, so the scene was that this girl, Mariah, she refused to do the community service that she was asked to do, so therefore she spent 3 months in an Israeli prison. And the video is coming back on her first day back, and the person who's doing the documentary of trying to understand the settlers, you know, and their approach of revenge has an interesting conversation with her, which I wanted you guys to hear. Here we go.
Arabs kill Jews and any Arabs kill Jews.
Can you explain to us what this price tag?
No, I don't really understand. After Arabs kill Jews and anything wrong that happened, we show that we won't stay in quiet. It has a price, and it's called price tag.
And it could just be any random error. It doesn't matter whether they were involved or not?
No, it doesn't. Because they sit here. because they believe it's theirs. They all involved.
And for you, that's guilty enough, just being here. That makes them guilty, yeah.
Yeah, that makes them guilty.
What did you, can you sort of tell us what you did exactly that you got sentenced to jail for?
I threw rocks on Arab's car. I don't think I did something bad.
So you don't think throwing rocks at Arab's is a bad thing to do?
I don't think revenge and our oivim, enemies, it's not bad. They hate us. And if we want to still live here safely, like Jews should live here, we need to bring them out of here.
But can you see it from their perspective, if someone who lived here for generations, how they might feel like this land belongs to them?
I don't care. I mean, according to the Torah, this is Eretz Israel. It belongs to us.
I mean, you don't think there's any way that Arabs and Jews can live here in peace?
No. They started a war with us. They don't have the right to stay here. God, the Jews, they don't have to eat for the Shulchan. It's all according to him. I don't care anything else. This is all.
You don't care matters. About laws. You don't care about like human rights or any of that. It's all according to the Torah.
The Torah has also human rights. The real human rights. You know, in the end, after we build our big Beit Mikdash, המטרה הגדולה היא להיות אור לגויים.
You know, these people like Mariah and her family and the other people here think that being on this land is their God-given right. And the land where we are right now in the occupied territories, if there's going to be a Palestinian state, this will be part of their state.
All right. Okay, so that's the first via. Basically, she feels that she has a right to take vengeance against any Arab who's in Israel at all. All right, I want to share another. So she's part of the Price Tag group. Another one, this is the more famous thing that got international attention, was the event here. Here we go.
18-month-old Palestinian boy has burned to death in an arson attack on two homes, which Israeli police suspect was carried out by Jewish extremists in the West Bank. The dead boy's 4-year-old brother and parents are severely injured. RT's Paula Slea is in Tel Aviv for us. Paula, hi, good to see you. So, do we know exactly what happened there?
Well, the information we have at the moment is that a 1.5-year-old Palestinian boy was burned to death and 3 members of his family are injured and in hospital after a suspected price tag event. Now, the term price tag is used by Jewish extremists who take their fate into their own hands. They carry out incidents such as this that aim to kill Palestinians or harm their properties. And they do this because they believe the government is not doing enough to support their cause. The information we have at this stage suggests that there were 2 radicals. They broke the windows of this baby's home. They threw Molotov cocktails inside. They did the same to a neighboring house, but fortunately there was no one inside that home. Now, the Israeli army has said that it suspects, because the words "Long live the Messiah" and "Revenge" were painted on the wall of the house, that it is a price tag event, and hence they are using their troops to try and find Jewish extremists in the area of Nablus. This happened in a village just short of this big Palestinian city.
Paula, what official reaction has there been to the attack?
Well, the IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces, has said that this is a barbaric act of terror. It also says that it slams all terror, including what it calls Jewish terror. Israeli soldiers are searching the area, and it reiterates the words of the Israeli Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, who said that this is a terror attack and the perpetrators will be brought to book. There are growing concerns on the ground that this could lead to violence. We've heard from Hamas calling for today to be a day of rage. Now, the Palestinian president, Mahmoud Abbas, however, has blamed the Israeli government for the attack, saying that such incidents would not happen if the Israeli government did not support settlers and the expansion of settlements. He's also criticized the international community for its silence, vowing that this incident and other incidents will be brought before the International Criminal Court.
Okay, Paula, thank you.
All right. Okay, so that's the I'm not sure everybody heard that. Okay, so today, let's see. Anybody want to summarize exactly what occurred with the splinter group in Israel who do these acts of vengeance and violence, and they say it's a price tag of Arab violence against the Jews, and they're taking their land, they're taking their hands, and they're putting their taking the law in their own hands and doing acts of violence. And of course, the one that happened literally a year ago today was a throwing in of several Molotov cocktails into an Arab village house, and the baby, and then I think also another member of the family was killed because of the attack. So let's just, I want to break this down because it's very appropriate. Okay, who could, so why is Mariah, and by extension all the members of the price tag group, why are they proud of their actions? Who could?
I feel like they're doing what's right, what needs to be done.
Okay. In other words, they feel they just based on what level of justification,
right?
Where are they feeling they're getting their justification to do acts of violence and even and murder against even children?
Well, they feel that they're following.
Okay. Well, one at a time. Go ahead. Okay. Let's have Alex, and then we'll go to Moshe Chaim. Go.
From their standpoint, they're following the Torah.
Right. So, what's their source of validation of their activities? Hashem.
The Torah says that Eretz Israel belongs to the Jews. So, therefore, anyone living in Eretz Israel and refusing to leave can be thrown out.
Not only thrown out, could be killed. They're defined as the enemies. And therefore, they have to, whatever comes to them, they deserve it. Okay? So who can give me strengths or weaknesses of her argument?
Well, a weakness is that even if, like, the Torah says that, it also says that you shouldn't kill people.
Well, so what will be their answer to that?
Probably something like the ends justifies the means. Well, first of all,
does the terrorist say you can't kill?
Well, no, you can kill in times of war, and I guess
What's the key word there? The terrorist says the Ten Commandments say lo tirtzach. How would you translate lo tirtzach?
Don't kill.
Murder.
Don't murder. What's the between don't murder and don't kill?
Defense killing or killing in war is not considered murder. Murder is, I guess, with no ration, no good reason. Can't explain it very well, but acts of war, killing for war and killing in defense are not considered murder.
Right. So
I think that murder is killing an innocent.
Say it again, Jenna. What?
I think that murder is killing an innocent person.
Okay. So you're all basically thinking that, in other words, murder is killing a person, you know, unjustly, an innocent person. In other words, so, for example, people who get killed in war, that's they always say it's a just war. They're being killed, but justly. Okay? That's a distinction. Is it an expression of justice or is it not expression of justice? Killing is unjust. Is a function of murder is a unjust killing. But you could have a just killing, which is basically, as you said, either A, killing in self-defense, one possibility, or in killing in the case of a legitimate war. All right? So they would say back to you, they say, no, the Arabs are at war with us. So what's your response back? Do you agree with her? Not agree with her? I'll strengthen the argument. They'll say, number one, the settlements are not an obstacle to peace. Why? Because we gave Gaza, we got rockets. So if we give them land, we just get more death. So our being in this in the settlements where Moriah lives is not an obstacle to peace. A. And B is, how do you deal with a bully? Do you try to reason with him or do you punch him in the nose? They're the bully. This is the language they understand. So I, despite the weak westernized mentality of the Israeli government, we are rightfully protecting and validating and strengthening the Jewish people. So what do you say to that? Do you agree with her? Well, there's a lot of silence on this call. So, anybody want to take a stab at this? So, I'll help you out. I'll help you guys out a little bit here. All right. Which is a question number four on the sheet over there. What is the difference between an ideologue and a critical thinker? I think there's a very important distinction, which is very valuable right now. An ideologue versus a critical thinker. What would you say the difference between the two?
And I guess an ideologue, you could say, is someone who kind of takes an idea and kind of completely sticks to it without analyzing if opposing points of view might be valid, which is what a critical thinker would do. So a critical thinker might always have in the back of their mind, maybe what I'm thinking is wrong. Maybe there is another way to look at this.
Well, correct. What, anyone want to add to that? That's a good point. An ideologue versus a critical thinker. How would you say the distinction is? All right. So I think Alice got essentially the point there. The idea is that an ideologue has certain cherished beliefs. That ideologue could be a Democrat. That ideologue could be a Republican. That person could be a settler. That person could be a peace now activist. It doesn't make a difference. In other words, they maintain their position and they're somewhat impervious to considering the area of nuance, to consider the area of gray. Okay? Let me share. So here in Israel, just to make it, so yeah, the Peace Now group, which will give you the ideological point, which is violence begets violence. Now, that is a statement that often can be true. And the settler will say that, well, the only way to deal with a bully is to punch him in the nose. And if you are weak and you show weakness, they will take advantage of you. Well, clearly there's a truth to that as well. Now, how do you systematically navigate these two opposing principles? There's one answer. It's not simple. Because there are many layers of complexity there. First of all, are there any great rabbis associated who are validating and who are actively validating the price tag position in Israel? Take a stab. No pun intended. Anybody have an idea? Is any notable rabbi validating the activities, the vigilante violent activities of the price tag group in Israel? Julie, what do you think? We don't hear a word you're saying. You gotta take yourself off of mute.
You're saying, is anyone monitoring their actions? Is that right?
Is there any rabbis that say, oh, that the position and the activities of the price tag group, these violent Israeli settlers, is true in accordance with Torah values?
I would assume not.
You are correct on that. There is no notable rabbi. In fact, just the opposite. They've been repudiated repeatedly. Now, the bottom line is, so that's also a tell that really that if they're claiming that the Torah is a source of validating their acts of revenge and no rabbi is signing off on that, that's not a good sign. Which means they have an ideology, and they don't want to be confronted with any kind of complexity here. Now, where was there a dialogue about this very issue in the earlier in the Chumash? Who can remember the story of issues of violence, issues of revenge, issues of being a critical thinker showed up first in the Torah?
Either going to be Cain and Abel or Noah, one or the other.
Nope, a little later than that.
Sodom and
Gomorrah.
What?
And the war with the king of Sodom.
No. I mean, that's related, but more particular, more closer to this Israel situation of today. Actually. All right, the story of the abduction of Yaakov's daughter Dinah, followed by Shimon and Levi, her brothers, going into the town of Shechem. Literally, it's happening in the same location 3,000 years later. Go into the town, and what do?
They kill everyone after they circumcise themselves.
Right. While the people were in their third day of recuperation, Shimon and Levi go into the town, wipe everybody out, rescue Dina, you know, and then there's a dialogue between Shimon and Levi and their father, Yaakov Avinu. What is Yaakov Avinu's position about their activity? Was he happy with it or was he not happy with it?
They were wrong.
What's his rationale? They may remember, there's a little Chumash question. You guys got to be up on your Chumash.
You ask me, whose rationale? The brothers or Yaakov's?
First Yaakov and then their response. One of the great little conversation snippets of the Parsha, of the Parsha Yo. Anybody know?
Yaakov's response, I think, was that he said that now that you've done it, now there'll be more violence because now all the other nations are going to come after us because don't you that we kill all these people.
Right.
And the brother's response, I think, was that should we let them treat our sister like a harlot?
Correct. So basically, he was upset at them for doing it because they're causing the Jewish people, which is only a size of a family now, to be in grave danger. And that's what the various Meforshim, the Rambam versus the Ramban, argue about. Were they right? First question, was it killing or was it murder? Question number one. He wants, even if he seems to indicate that intrinsically the activity of killing these people was not unjustified, but was profoundly foolish and dangerous. So he enters into the thing about it's problematic because there's going to be a tremendous response to this act of terror, and we're going to get nailed, and we're very few. And then they say back, well, they argued the other case, which is that bottom line is, if we allow this to happen, if we don't strike back forcefully, you're allowing that our sister should be treated like a prostitute, like a harlot. So the bottom line is, this really, in a certain sense, and they get, at the end of his life, he excoriates them, he curses them, he curses their anger. They acted with wrath, unjustifiably, and they were overtaken by their aggressive instinct. So the bottom line is that in the issues of, even if you're dealing with your enemy, it's not a cut and dry, black and white situation. And for just to show you the complexity of the situation, even if you have Arabs or Palestinians in the West Bank and they're acting aggressively, how to ameliorate that and not cause net more problems is not a simple solution. And also there is a thing called public opinion and boycotts and your relationship with the United States of America, which makes this issue very complicated. Not something that a 20-year-old girl can say, oh, the terrorist tells me to do this. Done. So the point of the matter is, I want to make a clear distinction between ideology and critical thinking and critical and expert thinking. We know that Koheles tells us that what? Eit l'shalom ve'eit l'milchama. There's a time for war and there's a time for peace. When particularly to apply that is not so simple. Okay? And in a certain sense, these issues really transcend ideology, either on the left or on the right. You don't want to be too passive. You don't want to be too aggressive. Now, when to know what to do is, shall we say, a very complicated affair, which really the vast majority of people don't even begin to have the qualifications to address. You know what I'm saying? Like somebody says, I know how to solve the Israeli Arab conflict. Yeah. It's like laughable on its on the most surface basic. Okay. So that's our introduction, if you will. Let's take a look at the Parsha. I'm backing up the story. The episode happens 9 verses in advance of the Parsha, but you can't appreciate the whole thing with Pinchas until you get the story. So I would like somebody would like to read. Who? All right. Moshe Chaim Doz, Bavakasha.
Starting Israel sins with Moab, that part?
Yes.
Israel was staying in Shittim when the people began to behave immorally with the Moabite girls. The girls invited the people to the religious sacrifices, and the people ate and worshipped the Moabite gods. Israel thus became involved with Baal Peor, and God displayed anger against Israel. God said to Moshe, take the people's leaders and have them impale the idolaters publicly before God. This will reverse God's display of anger against Israel. Moshe said to Israel's judges, each of you must kill your constituents who are involved with Baal Peor. The judges were still weeping in indecision at the communion tent entrance when an Israelite brought forth a Midianite woman to his brethren before the eyes of Moshe and the Israelite community. When Pinchas, the son of Eleazar, a grandson of Aaron the priest, saw this, he rose up from the midst of the assemblage and took a spear in his hand. He followed the Israelite man into the tent's inner chamber and ran them through, driving the spear through the Israelite man and women's groin. With that, the plague that had struck the Israelites was arrested. In that plague, 24,000 people had died.
Okay, you're not going to get more action in the Torah than pretty much that. That's a violent action scene, okay? So let's just put the whole thing in perspective. So the scene is like this. The Jewish people's camp is nearby the Moabite towns. And and they start to involve themselves morally with them, you know, have sexual relations with the Moabite girls. Now, according to the Tarsha Baal Peh, the oral law, actually, the women, you know, the question is, why do these women suddenly start to have relations with the Jewish men? What's going on there? So it's more akin that they were told to function, to help the homeland, help the Moabite homeland, that they should have the Jews get them involved in what? Sexuality, and then followed by idolatry, which they did, which they were told, according to the Talmud, by none other than Bilam himself, that by doing that would cause Hashem's wrath and punishment against them. Lo and behold, the Jews are involved in this, engagement in idolatry and sexual immorality, and there's a God displays anger against the Jewish people by sending a plague, a sickness against the Jews. Moshe dispatches the judges that need to do some very quick frontier justice and start going after the perpetrators of these idolatry and sexuality. Okay? Meanwhile, one guy who we'll learn in our parsha takes a Moabite woman who we'll find out is going to be a priestess and in front of everybody does an act of demonstration and takes her into his tent to have sex with her. Pinchas takes his spear, runs in after them, and as they're engaged in intercourse, skewers them both. The plague is stopped. Okay, I know there's a bunch of questions here. Let's go to the next part of the. We get to the parsha here. Okay, Moshe Chaim Dov, keep on going, baby.
God spoke to Moshe saying, Pinchas, the son of Eleazar, and grandson of Aaron the priest, was the one who zealously took up my cause among the Israelites and turned my anger away from them so that I did not destroy them. My demand for exclusive worship. Therefore, tell him that I have given him my covenant of peace. They shall apply a covenant of eternal priesthood to him and his descendants after him. It is given to him because he zealously took up God's cause and made atonement for the Israelites. The name of the man who was killed along with the Midianite woman was Zimri, son of Salu, and a prince of the Shimonite eternal line. The name of the Midianite woman was killed was Cosby, the son of Sur, governor of a paternal line in Midian.
Okay. Okay, so what is God's reaction to this event?
It's a great thing.
He did a great thing, and what's the reward package? He gets two things.
You get peace and you get to be a Kohen.
All right, so he's now going to be now. Even though that when God made Moshe when God made Aaron a Kohen, made him and his children, but he was not part of that line. So now he and his descendants will be added to the greater Levi group. He's now added into another line of Kohanim. He's made it into a Kohen. Bing. And he's giving the Brit Shalom, the covenant of peace, which of course is not clear what that is. One possibility, just to let you know, is that basically it's protection, because basically the fellow tribesmen of Shimon probably not too happy that Pinchas went ahead and skewered their leader. That does not tend to bring out good, warm feelings. So basically Hashem promises them protection. That's possibly number one. Another Brit Shalom is that he's going to live a very long life, and he does in Tanakh. He lives an exceptionally long life. In fact, so long, they want to say that, the Midrash wants to say that Pinchas is Eliyahu HaNavi, so that makes him like Highlander already. He's like living 1,000 years, miraculously. All right, be that as it may. All right, guys, what are the questions here? Any questions in this event, or does it make perfect sense to you?
I have a question.
Good.
How did Pinchas know inherently that by spearing those two people would end the plague?
He did not.
So how did he know that that was not murder, that that was doing the right thing?
Oh, that's a good question. Like, how did Pinchas know that that was the right thing to do? Because, you know, you would think that if something's important and done right in front of Moshe, who should have done it?
Moshe.
Or maybe you'll say number two, Joshua, who's the number two guy. Not this other guy that we never heard of. I know he's part of the Mishpach. I'm sure he's a great dude. But somehow this Pinchas guy steps up to the plate.
It's like making a citizen's arrest.
Right. It seems that the Torah on the surface is advocating for not only vigilante justice, but vigilante violence.
Well, there's two parts to this, though. One, it's a time of crisis, and the other being he didn't let himself get swept up with it.
What do you mean? What do you mean by the second item?
That there's all this immorality from the Midianites going around, and he's not engaging in it or saying, well, everyone else is enjoying this, why shouldn't I? He's saying this is wrong, and this has to stop immediately.
Okay, Now, didn't Moshe do that by dispatching all the judges to start prosecuting and adjudicating justice against all the idolaters who were involved in the immorality with the Moabite Midianite women?
But you have got a plague from God sweeping across the land, killing people, so that's obviously either not enough or not going fast enough.
Okay, so you're saying that it was only Pinchas who sort of saw the situation clearly. Even people who are superior to him did not. Now, let's dig a little deeper. Let's drill down a little bit. What's so terrible about what this guy did, Zimri, versus the other guys? There seems to be a qualitative difference what he's doing versus the rest of the people.
He's a leader and he's doing it in front of everyone.
Right. He takes the woman, and it says before the eyes of Moshe and the Jewish people. So he's making sure. In other words, is this an act of sexual passion?
No.
It's not like he has a tremendous lust for this beautiful Midianite princess, and he's sneaking off with her. No. He specifically, even after there's been a call to justice to reverse the course of events, this guy, who's a leader, who should know better, takes her and then parades her past Moshe and all the elders and all the people and goes right in front to clearly saying to Moshe and the people that what? What is he in his actions demonstrating?
That he has very big balls.
Well, that's true. That is true. But what is he saying? And what is his comment? His de facto comment is saying what to the entire Jewish people?
Someone has to step up.
Well, but what is the Zimri, the guy taking the woman? What is he basically de facto saying by taking in the Midianite princess into his tent?
Oh, that he's turning
his back. I don't care to what God says.
Right. What God says, what God does not like, God does not like Avodah Zarah, I don't care. God does not want us to have relations with these Midianite women, I don't care. Not only do I not care, but I'm creating a counterculture. I'm trying to demonstrate in front of everybody that this is the good life. And you're a fool if you don't do it. In other words, he's trying to create sort of a anti-command of God, a rebellion against God. Okay, that's the circumstance he's making, and that's why he brings her specifically past Moshe, past the elders, past everybody. They're basically like threatening, what are you going to do about it? You know, I hear what you're saying, what are you going to do about it? He's challenging them. Not only is it a rebellion, it's a challenge of Moshe's moral authority, which of course makes the question stronger why he did not, that Moshe himself didn't act. This, of course, perplexed not just us, part of the Tuesday Parsha group, but the rabbis of old in the Midrash. I'll share one idea. One was that he, when he came there, he says, Moshe, where's your wife from? Now, as you know, Moshe married who? He married a Midianite woman. And not only that, also a princess, a daughter of a Midianite priest called Yitro. Why is that a false argument? What is the difference between
before the Torah was given?
And therefore,
they didn't have official mitzvot.
Okay, and what happened? What's the deal with Sipora? What's her identity now?
She's Jewish now. She and her father converted later on.
Right, so she was there. She converted. In other words, she may have had a Midianite background, but she's as Jewish as Moshe is. She converted together with the Jewish people, either together or right or a little bit afterwards. So the fact that she was a Midianite princess herself, yeah, but she's not an idolater, she converted. So Zimri is using that as a sophistic argument to, argue that really, you know, look at the hypocrisy. He has the Midianite woman, why can't we? That's what he says. So apparently Moshe was stunned by that, and then we have Pinchas stepping up to the plate. Either he was stunned, or he felt that, being that he's now involved in the argument, it would be viewed as a personal vendetta. So, now I'm going to share let's take a look at the Rambam here, how he talks about, this is actually a halacha, of what they call kana'im pogimbo, that the zealous, in a certain case, is allowed to strike down those people who are involved. Okay, let's have somebody read it here. Who would like to? Any volunteers to read?
Okay.
Go ahead, read.
All right. Whenever a man has relations with a Gentile woman in public, example, the relations are carried out in the presence of 10 or more Jews, if the zealous person strikes him and kills him, he is considered praiseworthy and ardent. Applies whether the relations were in the context of marriage or licentious in nature. This matter is a halacha conveyed to Moshe at Sinai. Support for this can be derived from the first slaying of the
three. All right, stop right there. All right, so let me just review. The Ram says that if a man has relations with a Gentile, but really an idolater woman in public, and there's in front of 10 or more men, if the kanoi, the zealous guy, would kill him, it's considered praiseworthy. They use the word ardent, or, you know, it's praiseworthy and meritorious. Okay? It makes a difference if he's sleeping with her as a function of they're married or just a one-night stand. And there's a halacha which is conveyed to Moshe and Sinai. It's not mentioned overtly, but the proof can be seen with the fact that Pinchas killed Zimri and was rewarded. All right, let's go. But now there's some very interesting halachot here. All right, so Julie, belt it out.
The zealous person can strike the fornicators only at the time of relations, as was the case with regard to Zimri. As states, he pierced the woman into her stomach. If, however, the transgressor withdraws, he should not be slain. Indeed, if the zealous person slays him, he may be executed as a murderer. If the zealous person comes to ask permission from the court to slay him, they do not instruct him to, even if this takes place at the time of relationship. Not only that, if the zealous person comes to kill the transgressor, and he withdraws and kills the zealous person in order to save himself, the transgressor is not executed for killing him. When a Jew has relations with the daughter of a resident alien, the zealous may not strike him. The transgressor should, however, be given stripes for rebellious conduct.
Okay, let me review the halakha. This is a little bit complicated. All right. Follow me on this. The halakha is like this, that the kanoi, the zealous one, is only allowed to do this if it's done, number one, if it's being done in public, just like our story was. Number two, they're both physically connected, both together, the time of relations. If the guy withdraws, he's not allowed to kill him. Three, if the zealous one comes to ask the court, is he allowed to do that? They do not tell him to do it. If he asks, he doesn't. They don't tell him to do it. Fourth, if the guy transgressor would turn and throw a spear at the zealous one and kill him, he's not punished. He's not punished. So the thing is like this, that, so what's up with that? So wouldn't you say if the person's having this relationship with an idolatrous woman in public, is he obligated in death or not? Does the guy have to kill him? According to the Rambam, according to the oral law, does this guy who has relations with the idolatrous woman, does they have to be executed? Does the Kanai have to go through and do it? What do you guys say?
I don't think he has to.
Correct. He does not have to do it, which is also a weird thing. In other words, you would imagine either you're obligated to kill or not obligated to kill. What's up with this optional business? You could kill him, but you don't have to. And not only that, it's a risky thing. Because if he kills the man, they're no longer having relations with each other. He's culpable of the death penalty, A. B, not only that, if he goes and the other guy kills him, that guy is not subject to the death penalty either. So what the heck is going on here? What do you guys say? Any ideas here?
Well, one of the things I'm wondering is if it is like at all related to the concept of having a rabbinical court before you put someone to death, because I know that that's one of the things that's supposed to have to happen, that like that whole... it's not like a jury, but like a panel of rabbis. Everyone has to deem that there's like not a shadow of a doubt, and like you're basically supposed to, you know, make sure you're like very sure about stuff before you do it. I don't know if that's related or not.
Yeah, well, you've just actually strengthened the question, because here we have a death penalty, or a penalty of death being done by a non-judge. You know, what you would call in fancy language an extrajuridical death penalty. What's up with that? In other words, in general, if somebody violates, let's say person A goes to kill another person. So if you have two witnesses, they say, don't kill him, because else you're going to get the death penalty, and he does it anyways. That person is then prosecuted with a court of 23 judges. And if he found and they cross examine the witnesses, if the witnesses are found to be valid, that person is put to death. Okay? But there's so many different ways there are issues in the process that have to I's have to be dotted, T's have to be crossed, that in the Talmud says that a court that did two murder cases, killed two people in murder cases in 7 years, was called a bloody court. So it was rather rare to actually apply the death penalty. Okay? So here, this seems to be like an exception. Except that this guy could take out a spear like Pinchas and skewer people. So it seems to be... Jessica actually strengthened the question. All right. I got 6 minutes.
In a way, it's kind of similar, I feel like, to that law. Like, if someone accidentally kills another person, then
the closest relative of that person has the right to kill the person who killed him.
Yes.
Without a trial.
The Goel Hadam. Mm-hmm. Yes. Go on.
And it's also kind of a similar situation where normally there would be a trial, but if that closest relative happens to get to the guy first and kills him, then he's not liable. And basically it's kind of like just allows for someone in a rage, I guess, of after something really terrible has happened, someone just goes into a rage and just acts on it. And it allows for that person to, I guess, not be punished.
Okay, so that's a very good question. What Alex is bringing up is a case of what they call the Goel Hadam, the Avenger. When we get to Devarim, we'll tackle some of that case. That's also another example of extra juridical case where it's not identical, but the person is brought to Beis Din, and if he's judged to have killed somebody, what, by accident, he has to make it to the city of, flee to the city of refuge. On the way, or if he steps out of the city, the home base, if you will, and the Goel Adam sees him, and he shoots him and kills him, the guy is not punishable at all. He's not subject to that. So that's all. That's a shear in its own right. Let me try to tackle this. Here's the basic idea. So first of all, to our first question, does the Torah tolerate vigilantism? Well, the answer is really no. Because vigilantism, as the term refers to, is sort of like people have a person... feels that justice is not being done, and they take the law into their own hands, and they feel they're gonna apply the law in their own hands. Here, this is part of the legal system that a special person, not just anybody, who has clarity that this is a profound injustice, a profound what they call a chilul Hashem, a disgracing of God's name. Is allowed, does not have to do, to, he has the right to express that sense of, that there's a chilul Hashem going on, killing the person. Now, he can't just vent his aggression. It's only if he kills them and it's evident in their togetherness that they are publicly repudiating the concept of idolatry, like, they're repudiating Hashem by engaging in this public act of sex with a idolatrous woman. A. Two is if they separate, he cannot do it. Three, if he asks the great court, can I do this? They don't give him permission. Why is that? I believe the answer is if he doesn't have the clarity to apply the principle in that certain case, he's not the one who should be doing it. And they don't allow him to do it. They said, you can't go. Simultaneously, if he goes and the guy throws an arrow and kills him, he's not punished, the transgressor. He has, because he's, he did it as a function of onus, of being without any, it wasn't his fault. He was just purely protecting himself. He's not blamed for trying to protect himself. So quite frankly, the person has to be like a Pinchas-like person, a person who's on a very high level, who has clarity of how to apply the principle, who's willing to get into a measure of danger, and does this. He doesn't have to do this, but he feels compelled to do this. A regular terrorist who feels a level of religious passion is not going to do it in this very circumscribed manner. He's not going to make a distinction if they're together or they're separate. He's going to go in there and just kill them because he feels that God justifies that. But so the fact is that there's so many precise laws, it really is the area of a Pinchas, a person who is by definition, whose general manner is peace. That's he's given he's a Kohen. He's a person who reaches out to the community. But there is a rare event where you have to stand up. That is only for great people to make that call. That's not an example of, like in our case, a 20-year-old girl feels that she could, on behalf of the Jewish people, take revenge against Arab by throwing rocks at their cars. Or, God forbid, throwing a Molotov cocktail into a baby's room and killing a baby. First, we don't have a category like that, but these kind of issues and life and death issues are not for a regular person to be involved in. The category does exist. It is rare. It is highly prescribed. It is categorically very narrow. But the bottom line is, the area of applying justice, whether through the court or outside the court, has to be done with absolute precision by a great person. The people who are in the West Bank who are doing these price tag attacks are not on that level. Evidence is they don't even have any noted rabbi that's supporting their activities, and they're failing to see any nuance in these areas. They're taking a very simple case, like, well, they're enemies. We can do whatever we want. Life, and it's not so simple. And even this case, which seems to be taking justice in your own hands, is not a simple affair. He wasn't just taking justice in his own hand. He was applying a very precise principle in a very limited case, and he was rewarded for his courage and valor, because basically he really should have expected the entire tribe or the remaining members of the tribe of Shimon to be very angry that he went ahead and killed their priest. To put it very simply, the bumper sticker point of the basic thing of tonight's class is that Pinchas was a great man, and he had the right to do this act of sanctifying God's name through an act of murder. But a regular Jew, we're not in the realm of dealing with life and death questions. That's what they call, in the vernacular, above our pay grade. This is not an area for any of us on the call, myself included. Obviously, somebody comes to get you kill them first, that's obviously, but if you're not, but to go ahead and, start to attack innocent people because they're under the category of Arabs, that is not right, a profound injustice, and not smart, and oftentimes counterproductive of trying to create a safe home in the land of Israel. Any questions?
Yes, this is Dennis. My question is, we have sages and prophets and judges and all these generations we're so far removed from, and now we're here in this lifetime, and yes, there are great rabbis and reputable sources for sure in our generation, but are you saying these are the people that can apply such a law should it happen, or not?
So, look, where people are fighting, let's say relatively simple situations. Let's say there's the Egyptian army, the Jordanian army, the Syrian army, the PLO, who are attacking the Jewish people. This is not the responsibility of any individual Jew. This has to be done. This requires a military response, and that's called a milchemet mitzvah, a war of mitzvah, okay? That's one thing. So it's not done as an individual, it's done as a community, it's done in a lawful manner. You know what I'm saying? And part of the Israeli army, in addition to having lawyers, there's a chief rabbi of the IDF. And these questions about rules of engagement and rules of combat are the areas that they deal with. So this has to be done by experts. And the issue of the protection of the people of the state of Israel has to be left with the state of Israel. the military, the IDF, the Israeli Defense Force, the police, the Mishtara, and the official bodies, which have, you know, both lawyers and rabbis who provide guidance for terms of engagement. But an individual Jew is going to take the land, justice on their own and just take out a gun and start shooting from the hilltops, you know, anybody who's driving a car with Palestinian plates is really no different than a Hamas person. No different. Because even Pinchas operated through a framework of a halacha, of a law. It wasn't outside the legal system. It was inside the legal system, which has certain cases which does not use a court. So that's a very important distinction. Meredith, I don't know if that answered your question or not. Right, they provide guidance to their soldiers about what to do. Now, the part of that video which I did not show you is her brother who says that he and his friends are going to join the Israeli Defense Force. But what they plan to do is they're going to learn how to fight. And if they're told to do a command, which they don't find, you know, correct, they're not going to listen. So that, of course, is tremendously dangerous because you're going to cause the breakdown of the entire military system if you're not going to have the chain of command. So these people are, are very dangerous because they're going to they think they're going to help the Jewish people, but by having, where insurrection, rebellion is part of the Israeli army, that's a big problem. And again, there's no rabbi saying what their application of the Torah is valid. So that's always a big tip-off. So are they involved in a intelligent, nuanced, critical thinking application of Jewish law? Or they have an aggressive ideology and they just want to have revenge? And conversely, the Peace Now people that say that I don't want to join the Israeli Defense Force because I don't want to be involved in, fighting the Palestinians ever. That's also wrong. You know what I mean? So you can have the ideology on the left or on the right, and you think that you're helping the Jewish people when in reality you're not. And these things have to be dealt with expert opinion and done by not just one individual, but by a body of military and Jewish scholars. And that's the realm of where these issues get dealt with. I hope that's clear. So basically, Judaism is not into vigilantism. It does have certain circumstances where justice will be done, not through a court, but it's still under the banner of the law. That's the basic point. I mean, there's for example, one of the issues that the Israeli Defense Force is dealing with about the issue of destroying the house of a terrorist. Is that really produce more peace, less terrorism? So they also rely question of look into the empirical studies. Does it really help things or hurt things? The issues of what extent, like in Gaza, when they go into the Gaza, how much collateral damage can they do? Because having profound negative public opinion also is a harm to the Jewish people. In other words, this situation is not simple. Even if you have a situation on a local road in the West Bank, it's automatically an international thing. Whatever the Jews does, it's on the paper. It's in the paper. So it's, therefore, the complexity to navigate things are even more complicated. It's not simple. I don't have the. I'm not saying what the answer is. I don't know. I'm telling you, it's out of my pay grade. And to oversimplify the things into stock ideological things, I think really is a. It's not the Torah way. You're going to do the wrong thing. It's a profound disservice. And a person has to be humble. Like, what really are the areas that I can really adjudicate or be involved in and decide? The answer is, this ain't it. All right, guys. I want to thank you all. And again, thank you for participating in our special shiur done in memory of Mel Applebaum. May his memory continue to be a blessing for all who know him and for many, many more. All right, guys, wishing you guys a great night, and thanks for joining. And next week we're continuing on. I will be in Israel, but Rabbi Jonathan Sachs will do it the next 2 weeks. All right, guys, have a great night.
Thank you, Rabbi.
You're very welcome.
Thank you, Rabbi.